Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Monday, September 30th. From HPR2, it's The Conversation. To start the week, a planetary enemy that's 95% unmasked. A UH researcher for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change leads us to the mirror. And men protesting domestic violence mirror behavior they hope others will emulate.
And we'll frolic in the foliage, a mockumentary soon to screen at the Hawaii International Film Festival, made by MidPack Senior.
Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. You're listening to The Conversation. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You know, there's a concern that you and I have expressed talking to one another that we're living in a world these days that has learned to distrust science.
Well, especially after the 50s and 60s when science was so much promoted, it's ironic that we are in the place where we are now, which sort of leads us to our first conversation. Scientists on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change now say they're 95% sure they know the enemy of the planet, and it's us. The conference in Sweden ended as we went into the weekend with that announcement. It moved the position of the panel's last meeting from pretty sure humans were the cause to a reliable certainty. That may not be a big surprise to you, but the panel's projections just might be. UH researcher Axel Timmermann is the lead author on the chapter of the report. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Bethan. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, the report itself was being formulated over the weekend and is only being released today in its final form, but we got a preview of it as we were coming into the weekend. And the six statements that it took those 110 governments many, many hours to formulate are fairly simple and straightforward. Can you start by just reading those six statements so that people can be with us on the same page?
Sure. Actually, there are more than six statements in there. There's a pretty big summary for policymakers, about 35 pages. But these are the basic messages, really, take-home messages. Warming of the climate system is unequivocal, and since the 1950s, many of the observed changes are unprecedented over decades to millennia. In the Northern Hemisphere, 1983 to 2012 was likely the warmest 30-year period of the last 1,400 years. The atmospheric CO2 levels are unprecedented in at least the last 800,000 years. The ocean has absorbed about 30% of the emitted anthropogenic carbon dioxide, causing ocean acidification, and it is extremely likely, that's the 95% statement, that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. And the last one is quite important for the regional aspects of climate change. The contrast in precipitation between wet and dry regions and between wet and dry seasons will increase over the next 50 to 80 years.
Now, those, are you saying, have been distilled from 35 pages worth of report and a lot of time spent to be able to get words very right and where there was reasonable agreement, which is a tough thing to do when you've got 110 governments there. But for us in Hawaii, there's some real importance in what has happened with this report in many levels for what we're looking at with sea level rise and maybe saying goodbye to Waikiki in 80 years. But especially looking at how we now have the opportunity to manage or not manage what we're seeing right here and right now with rainfall.
Right. So the IPCC report is actually a 2,400 pages thick document. And the summary for policymakers that got released actually last Friday is really a very condensed version of it. The 2,400 pages actually include a very sophisticated analysis, very elaborate analysis of sea level change, for example, regional climate change, processes, phenomena that are associated with regional climate change, such as the El Nino Southern Oscillation phenomenon, monsoons, there is a discussion on past climate change. How did ice ages actually form and so on. So it's a very, very comprehensive document. This document summarizes and assesses basically the science of global warming, of climate change, past, present, and future. And in this document, there are several chapters that deal with the regional aspects of climate change. But unfortunately, the IPCC climate projections, they are based on relatively coarse models, so it's very difficult to use them at face value for climate change assessments here for the Hawaiian Islands, in terms of rainfall in particular. But the main numbers actually to remember is, depending on which CO2 emission scenario you choose, Hawaii will either experience a warming of about 1 Fahrenheit for a low CO2 emission scenario, or a warming of up to 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit if we continue basically the way we do right now in terms of CO2 emissions. Sea level rise is expected to reach about 1 foot for the low emission scenario to about 3 feet by the year 2100.
Which gives us some time to do some planning. But if I'm hearing you say correctly that although this was assessing something that we obviously have some time to do with coming up, part of it is accepting that this needs to be done right now. That seems to be much more challenging for a lot of people to get their minds around, because you look at 80 years from now, what may be the reality of it may be a little tougher for people to plan now, even though we can look back and say, well, World War II was not that long ago either, and you're looking with roughly the same thing, and we see that as being accessible. It's tougher to look off perhaps in the future. What is the big takeaway you think for Hawaii with this that we need to do policy-wise right now, regardless of some of the other impacts that we may see with rainfall?
So first of all, the IPCC report is not policy prescriptive. It's policy relevant. But as a private citizen, I would just say it's a very simple message. Safe energy is the first thing. Very often we always think about switching to alternative energy resources. That's, of course, a complementary effort. But what's really important is that we start to save energy. In particular, in this country, so much energy is wasted. And I think a huge amount of CO2 reductions could actually be implemented by going to more efficient ways of using energy.
And especially, though, as we're talking about how we want to change our agricultural base, and forgive me for harping on the rainfall part, but we've heard so much from UH that our rainfall patterns are changing, and we have to take that into consideration, too. So if you couple those two things, is there a prescription that you would give us as we look toward the next even 20 years?
For Hawaii in particular, sir?
For Hawaii, yes.
Well, I guess I'm leaving a little bit the arena of a climate scientist, but what I see is that there are so many resources available here in Hawaii, wind, solar. It's actually surprising that not more of these resources are harvested. So I would like to see a Hawaii that's much more sustainable in the future, that uses energy resources that are available here on these islands rather than importing fossil fuels. And I think it could be accomplished. At the same time, really, the efficiency of energy usage has to be improved tremendously here in this country.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Axel Timmerman is a UH Manoa Professor of Oceanography and the leader of UH Manoa International Pacific Research Center's Paleoclimate Research Unit. Since 2010, he's been working as a lead author of a chapter on paleoclimate in the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report. You can find out more on hpr2.org.
Just when you were getting used to this place, and you were getting used to these bones, and you were getting used to the changes, well, change won't leave you alone. You finally caught up with...
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:13. I'm Chris Vandercook. Coming up, a Monday dose of caffeinated conversation, a little faux film foliage, and now, pull out your pencils. It's time for your quiz.
In today's backyard, we're remembering a pioneering moment in the history of communications, with scientists at the University of Hawaii present at the creation. It began when a newly appointed faculty member, Norm Abramson, was looking for a project and for a problem to solve. The year was 1967, and the notion of communication between computers was brand new. Abramson and his team were considering ways to use low-cost commercial radio equipment to connect users on Oahu and the neighbor islands with a central time-sharing computer on the UH Manoa campus. At the time, radio communication was point-to-point, one broadcast channel, one destination, and that was a huge limitation. The UH scientists came up with a system that formed the basis of today's wireless communication, a truly revolutionary idea for those early days of computer technology. Our backyard quiz question for today, what was it called? We'll communicate the answer to you wirelessly in the next half hour. And while you think about the quiz, being that it is a Monday, we like to put our finger on the pulse of people sipping coffee at a morning spot. Today, Bill Sage is in Hawaii Kai with folks at Island Brew. Hey, Bill, what's brewing?
Good morning to you, Beth Ann. Right now, the thought which is on people's mind is, how will the shutdown affect us? It seems like it's going to go starting to shut down sometime around 10 hours or so from now. And with us this morning, we have Maya and Enrique. And Maya, you're involved in a yoga business, and yoga and the shutdown somehow does seem to go together per se, but in the fact that the ripple effects from Washington affect us all, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I'm concerned that people will disregard things that they think are expendable, like taking care of their health, like having a preventative health care option like yoga, when they start to feel the pinch in their pocketbook. But one of my first teachers used to say, health is not everything, but everything is nothing without health. So I try to encourage my students to remember to take care of themselves. So I'm thinking a lot about that and how I can encourage my students to maintain a consistent practice that keeps them well and focused and calm, so they can effectively act instead of just reacting with fear or anxiety throughout the day to these challenges that are facing us.
So you think it will be a ripple effect affecting health, not just... From our point, ironically, the whole thing is about the shutdown of the government, which might affect passing Obamacare and other things. So people have to maintain their health, and you think you can do it just by being proactive?
Well, I do believe that having a practice that keeps your body moving, not just your mind. We're used to moving our minds all the time and working them really hard, but using your breath and working your body and getting your blood flowing, we know that that reduces stress and tension, and we know that that in turn prevents some disease. So I'm sure that that's going to help. And in fact, if everybody did yoga or at least some physical activity, I know we would have less people in need of healthcare for things that are preventable, like diabetes and heart disease. So I do think that it's a great answer. I think we should require universal yoga care.
Back in the mainland, Washington, D.C., senators and congressmen take yoga and don't take our money, perhaps. Enrique, what is your opinion on this impending shutdown?
Well, I just think that while they are stuck in their political reality, everybody else has to deal with the natural reality, and there are real issues that need to be taken care of.
So if they do take care of it, we can take care of business. Laura, are you here for the conversation, too? We have a third guest coming on, and Laura, right now we're talking about the impending shutdown, how it's going to affect people. How will it affect you, do you think?
Sorry.
We're talking about the government shutdown, and it seems like it's going to happen in about 10 hours or less. And have you given thought to how that might affect you and the people that you're with?
No, I haven't. I heard about it, but I hadn't thought about how it'll directly affect me. I don't work for the government, so I was thinking about my friends and people that do and how it may affect them, but I know it's going to affect everybody.
Okay, well, if everybody gets affected one way or another, do you see a ripple effect for anything? So what line of work are you in?
I'm a breast surgeon.
So a breast surgeon, and well, of course, is Obamacare part of how will, you know, the practice? Will they pass the health bill, or will it be implemented and funded? How will this affect overall the surgery?
I think they'll pass it, but it won't go into effect until 2014. So there may be some hold up behind the scenes with people trying to register and get their health insurance.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Laura. So it's whether it's foremost in the back of your mind, things like this are going to happen. So have a cup of coffee, do a little yoga, make sure your health is all right. Relax, and we'll see you next week. We'll be out at Rockies in Waipahu. We may or may not be open for business government-wise, but we'll just have to see. In the meantime, take a deep breath and smell the coffee. Back to you in the studio.
One look at your smartphone and you know it's true. There's a revolution underway in movie making, and it's right at your fingers. The generation of young directors that's just now coming of age has grown up speaking the language of film with inexpensive equipment that brings shooting, editing, and even distributing a film within the reach of high school students working with almost no budget. Adam Simon is one of them. A senior at MidPack Institute, he's the director of a film that'll be shown at the Hawaii International Film Festival, Foliage, Roots of the Tree Barrel. He's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, it used to cost a lot of money to do the kind of things that you've been doing.
Yeah, well, that's not the case anymore.
I know. And you're a beneficiary of that, aren't you?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. Working with rented equipment, working with equipment from a school, and working with my own low-budget purchases, I can create, like, some very high-quality content visually, which has been amazing.
Where did you, well, first of all, where'd you get your motivation to do this from?
Where did I get my motivation? Well, I'm still finding that motivation, but I just find that when I'm not busy, I tend to be miserable as a teenager. And, you know, and film as a form of artistic expression will keep you busy. And that's been my motivation. It's like I can finally get consumed in something and be passionate about it. And now I can do this on the cheap, which is great.
In film, you better be consumed by it because it's never going to leave you alone, right?
Oh, yeah. It's taken over every aspect of my life. I hate to say it, but it's become it's pushed school off to the side. Now this is something I really want to focus on. And if I want to do it as a career, I'm beginning to realize, like, oh, like, I have to be doing this 24/7. This cannot leave my mind.
Well, you don't want to leave behind the things that school is giving you either.
Oh, undoubtedly. It's still school's a priority. But as far as my actual mental state, I think I'm always digesting what I'm doing artistically before I really focus on what's going on at school.
Do you have a sort of a long-term idea about what kind of filmmaker you want to be?
Well, I think it's premature to have any certainty as to what kind of filmmaker I want to be. But as cliche as it is, I'd really like to be genuine and true in whatever I'm making. And if that means no mainstream success, that might have to be the case.
Who are the filmmakers that struck you as being genuine and true when you were looking for inspiration?
Well, film is always dramatized. It's a form of drama. There's always going to be hyperbole and exaggeration and embellishment. But in particular, I think Darren Aronofsky is someone who has done things, no matter how extreme, he's avoided being just a gimmick. Darren Aronofsky has done films about addiction and about schizophrenia and whatnot, but they always seem to remain very genuine, at least
from my
perception.
He did The Wrestler, did Black Swan, the ballet movie.
Yeah. So he's able to approach very difficult and dramatic subjects without seeming too superficial.
And yet he goes into the realm of the fantastic, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly. But, you know, the fantastic can be genuine, and I think he does that well. Another case of that for me, I really appreciate the films of Wes Anderson, just because no matter how ridiculous they are, he's doing them for the right reasons. They always seem to be so real.
Well, the film that you have made seems to be more along the Wes Anderson line of kind of absurdist comedy. Yeah,
undoubtedly.
Is that kind of where it's going?
Yeah, right now, Foliage is just, it's a mockumentary, and it's absolutely absurd. It's satire, and it's ridiculous. But we really believed it, so I'd like to consider it genuine.
Well, you sort of have to have a vein of sincerity in order to be satirical, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's true.
What
I'm
was
not sure
it that
yet.
You're satirizing?
Well, we took, I say we because I worked with a bunch of people, but we took the traditional surf film and the traditional skateboarding film and that entire culture, and we turned it on its head, and we created something called, or we didn't create, but we played on something called the tree barrel, which is when surfers, maybe when the waves are down or skateboarders are just messing around, and you skateboard under a low-lying tree, and it emulates the experience of being in the barrel.
That's as close as you get to being tubed on dry land,
yeah,
right?
It's about as close as it's going to get, yeah.
So you sort of invented a subculture of a subculture, in a sense.
Yeah. Tree barreling is always something that people have been doing for years, jokingly, and we just took it way too seriously, and it turned out to be hilarious.
And that's kind of what a lot of documentaries that aren't trying to be mock documentaries do, uh-huh. right?
Yeah.
They take something incredibly serious. I'm thinking of some of the skateboard documentaries which treat it as if it were mm-hmm. the church.
Yeah, that was for me because I don't skateboard that much and I don't really surf that much, but my parents were surfers, my friends are surfers and skateboarders. And being around that culture, you'd think that these people are joking sometimes because they talk about it as a lifestyle, and you watch surf films and you watch skate films, and it's so passionate. And for someone who's not in that world, it just seems so monotonous. It seems like a joke. So
yeah.
By parodying that, I had a lot of fun, and it turned out to be something that not just I, but other people could relate to and enjoy.
One of the things that you find in a lot of surf documentaries and skateboard documentaries is people living for a moment that they're unable to describe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I definitely played off that a ton in my film. Working with my friends who are all skateboarders and surfers or have been surrounded by the culture, we know exactly the language and that exact feeling of indescribable moments. And everyone knows how people talk about that. And so all my friends, when we did interviews, were able to emulate that exactly.
Because it's pretty hard to talk about an indescribable moment except by saying, I can't describe it.
Without saying ridiculous things. But we love those ridiculous things.
What kind of ridiculous things they say?
Oh, man. I can't say too much without having to watch the film, but it's just
But that's kind of where you go, huh?
Yeah,
just that. Heard that the somewhat inarticulate devotees.
Yeah, the inarticulate, just people sounding like they're under the influence because they're so passionate about it.
Well, I wish you all kinds of luck with your film. I'm assuming it's not your last, right?
Oh, definitely not. We'll see what's next, but I'm really excited to see where this goes.
Great. Thanks very much for coming in.
Of course.
Adam Simon is a senior at MidPack Institute whose film, Foliage, Roots of the Tree Barrel, will be shown at the Hawaii International Film Festival Saturday, October 19th. And you can learn more about him at hpr2.org.
We talked about global climate change. Now some in Hawaii are also considering whether the legal climate might be right for a few changes, too. Last week, Marijuana Minister Roger Christie pleaded guilty to trafficking pot. Could his plea change reinvigorate the argument to legalize weed in the Aloha State? Some suggest it might be high time. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's Reality Check. Hi, Chad.
Did I write that, Beth Ann? I think I did.
You wrote that in your note to me. I had to use it. But really, truly, here we are with a man who's been incarcerated the last 3 years. Now he changes his plea, and suddenly lots more questions are coming up about whether or not we should legalize pot at this point. What's this part of the conversation changing that his 3 years of incarceration perhaps didn't?
Well, there's a couple of things, and I know we could talk about this forever, but I remember that the legislature, several senators actually had resolutions asking to give Roger Christie time out on bail. Remember, he was not granted bail. He was considered a danger to the community. So clearly the state Senate was following the situation. There was another resolution that says, you know, maybe his constitutional rights are being violated. Could the Justice Department take a look at this? But more substantively, there was a bill to decriminalize marijuana for possession of an ounce or less. That bill is still alive for next session.
Well,
so is another
yeah.
bill. Technically, exactly. And so is another bill on hemp, on whether we should cultivate hemp for commercial use. Hemp is the part of the cannabis plant that won't get you high. So one wonders if the Christie trial, there is no trial, it's a plea bargain now, but might it raise attention on what Hawaii should be doing in terms of its marijuana laws?
Well, Kat Brady has been trying to do that for a very long time.
Oh, yes.
She's the coordinator of the Hawaii Community Alliance on Prisons, and she's been saying, you know, the people who are being incarcerated for low-level drug offenses clog up the system, and they cost us a lot of money. And just out of a matter of financial prudence, shouldn't we look at maybe making this decriminalized?
So we'll talk about this more. As you know, we've only just begun to touch the topic, but thank you for your time this morning.
And thanks very much for joining us. We'll talk to you soon. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:30. You're in on the conversation on HPR2. This half hour, men march on domestic violence, and don't touch that building. Historians make the case to forego the urge to raise a wrecking ball.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Honua Kai Resort and Spa on Maui, offering studios and 1, 2, and 3-bedroom suites, dedicated to creating an experience where families and friends connect and make memories. HonuaKaiMaui.com.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, it's fair to say a lot of people are going to have a lot of questions for you tonight.
Absolutely. We're going to talk today about the Health Connector that's going online October 1st, tomorrow, and we're going to go through some of the details. Who needs to be involved? What are they going to see when they log on? And what are some of the options available?
So there is someone somewhere who understands all this, huh?
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I've been looking into it quite a bit, but I'm excited that we're going to talk to the people running the connector, because that way we're going to get the word from the people who created this system here in the islands and be able to ask some questions about some of the logistics that everybody's concerned about.
Is it fair to say there are a lot of questions to be sorted out here?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions specifically about the connector, and then there's a whole host of questions about the Affordable Care Act. So we're going to focus on the connector today and how that fits into a piece of the ACA, and then we'll figure out how things go after that. And maybe we'll have another talk about what everyone's calling Obamacare, depending on what happens with the potential government shutdown.
And it's fair to say that there are a lot of that everyone is in some way going to be affected by changes to come, yet to come, yeah?
Well, I think if we just remember the general principles, doctors want to keep people healthy. People don't want to get sick. If you look at it with that sort of a perspective, then sometimes all these other things that fit in, you can see where they take place and where this all comes together. But I think we get bogged down in a lot of details, and so we'll try and take a broader overlook and see how that goes.
Well, it's a valuable service, Kathy. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. That's tonight at 5.
Aloha, I'm Karuna Pyle from Punahou School. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
As noted in several conversations this morning, some issues are slow to change. Right up in that category is domestic violence. Over decades, the understanding of attitudes toward the forms of domestic violence and the availability of help have grown. So, too, the involvement of men. This week, they will rally and walk beginning at the state capitol for the 19th annual Men's March Against Domestic Violence. David Tomilowitz is this year's chair, and he joins us this morning. Hi there.
Hi, Bethann. Thanks so much for having me on this morning.
Well, we've talked a lot about domestic violence over the years, and still seeing some of those same stats turn up now is, on one hand, disappointing. On the other hand, more people know about those stats, so that seems to move the conversation toward understanding that this is very much a part of our community. One in four women in a lifetime will be affected by domestic violence. That hasn't changed in quite a while, has it?
I think that the statistics continue to be disappointing. About one in four women in a lifetime prevalence, and a CDC study in 2010 said that something like 37% of Hawaii women will report having been a victim of domestic violence, stalking, or sexual violence in their lifetime. So it is obviously still a problem. The other perspective that I have and the reason for the Men's March is, although 85% of victims of domestic violence are female, of course the majority of perpetrators are men. So I think what the Men's March hopes to bring to the conversation is that this is not just an issue for women to be talking about, but this is an issue for men to be engaged in as well, and that we need to be part of the solution.
That, in fact, it's crucial that you're part of the solution and having conversations with younger and younger men and boys as they approach dating age and a time where they start to have a great deal of questions about how they fit in and what a relationship is all about.
Yeah, what we're asking for this year is for men of goodwill and good character to join us for the Men's March. We'll have about 500 or perhaps a little bit more attendees, of which about 300 will be high school boys. So this is really an opportunity for role models from our community to come out and to set the example for our young men and to let them know that domestic violence is really not acceptable behavior.
And how do you take it beyond the Men's March? Because here we've had it for almost 20 years, and it's all well-intended. It's very, very good thing that happens, but what happens between one march and the next really seems to be what will make this issue, if not go away, because it's not going to happen anytime soon, but at least get a little better.
Yeah, the theme of the march this year is that domestic violence is everybody's business. And one of the evolutions or changes that's happening this year is that we're asking the corporate community to participate as well. One of the things, and I, as the prior publisher for Hawaii Business, and when I got involved in looking at the domestic violence issue, come to realize this is a business issue as well as a community issue and a moral issue. And the cost to businesses is actually quite substantial. So a business of 500 employees would expect to see about $100,000 a year in costs due to domestic violence, either healthcare costs or absenteeism and so forth. So a number of businesses are coming out to support the march this year, and I think that's something that's interesting and positive. And the other thing that I would suggest in terms of how new approaches are being attempted, with relation to domestic violence. My current employer, Kaiser Permanente, has spearheaded a family violence prevention program here in Hawaii Market starting in 2011. And what we really are trying to do is to move the identification of domestic violence out of the emergency room, which is typically where we will become aware of victims of domestic violence, into the primary care setting. So our doctors are proactively asking both men and women about their home life and about, if there's tension and violence in their home life, to try to understand if they may be victims of domestic violence. And what this is, in fact, done is increase the identification of domestic violence substantially. In Northern California, where the program was initiated, it increased the identification of domestic violence by about 5 times. And that's significant not only because it gives us a sense of how hidden this problem is, but it also moves the identification out of the ER into the primary care setting, where we can actually do something about that before the victim ends up, in our emergency room.
And it puts it in a place that becomes just part of the conversation that you would have with your doctor about anything that is not right in your life.
Yeah, the one thing that to me has been so surprising as I've gotten involved in talking about this issue is how stigmatized the issue of domestic violence is and the sort of shame that surrounds this issue. And I think not only on the part of victims of domestic violence, but I really think on behalf of the community at large, I think that we're just ashamed that this is something that takes place here in Hawaii and confused about what to do. So the point of the march itself is to shed some light on this and to have folks come out in public and say that this is something that we stand in solidarity with victims of domestic violence on, and this is something that we really need to talk about.
We also have heard from many people, as we've talked about this over 14 years, particularly on Town Square, that we're still very reticent to get involved in somebody else's life, and that there's a sense of, well, we may have a gut feel that something is not quite right with a friend, a neighbor, a coworker, but trying to make a place to open up a conversation is still really tough.
Yes, I think there's a couple of ways to respond to that. The one is that the costs to the community are great in terms of our social services and so forth. So this is an issue that the community really needs to be engaged in. The other is that we do need to respect the wishes of victims of domestic violence, but we also need to make ourselves available and to let them know that we support them and to make sure that they're aware of resources that exist to help support them. And I think this is the opportunity not only for healthcare providers to be providing access and information about those resources, but also for employers to let domestic violence victims or suspected victims know that the employer stands with them and that the employer is willing to help them to access resources from the community.
Well, especially for small businesses where that may be even more visible than if you have a larger 500-plus employee group.
Well, I think for businesses of all sizes. And one of the things that I would suggest is the Domestic Violence Action Center has a program for businesses and for HR professionals called DV Action Ready, where they'll come in and do trainings, whether it's with the HR staff or with the employees all told, to let them know, what the options are and how to approach this really difficult issue.
And let's say we talk to each other next year before the 20th anniversary march. What's the one thing you'd like to see happen between now and then?
What I'd like to see is more employers get involved in the DV Action Ready program and to really understand the significance of domestic violence and the impact on the workforce. I think that, to me, would be a real positive step forward.
Well, let's see if it happens. Meanwhile, good luck with Thursday's march.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. David Tomilowicz is Director of Business Engagement at Kaiser Permanente and this year's chair of the 19th Annual Men's March Against Domestic Violence. He serves as a board member for a handful of organizations and was a 2010 Pacific Century Fellow. More about the march on HPR2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ala Moana Centers, the Fall Fashion Event. Three fashion-inspired days of in-store events and runway shows, beginning this Friday. Details at alamoanacenter.com.
Hi, I'm Carol Kellett. I'm a librarian at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and also an HPR volunteer. I'm looking forward to being in the studios during Celebration 2013, helping out with answering your phone calls. If I don't listen to HPR every day, I can feel my brain shrinking because it hasn't been fed with new information. HPR nourishes my brain cells in so many more ways than I can count. Help support HPR. It's all about things that matter.
Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and time for Stargazer, our weekly guide of what to look for in our island skies. We've got Sean Lotch from the Emilio Astronomy Center on the line, our official conduit to the research community atop Mauna Kea. Hey, Sean, aloha. What are we going to be looking for this week in our stargazing experience?
Aloha, Dave. Greetings from Mauna Kea. New moon is on Friday, so the first part of the week, try catching a view of the waning crescent moon in the eastern sky just prior to sunrise. On Tuesday, Mars and the moon will make a nice pair in the morning sky at that time. Venus and Saturn are in the western sky at sunset, while Jupiter rises after midnight in the eastern sky. And try catching Mercury near a young crescent moon on Sunday in the western sky at sunset.
Wow, I like that. There's a whole lot of planets to be looking for this week. How about unusual activities?
This week, Sunday, look for the Draconid meteor shower. This shower should yield between 6 to 10 meters an hour, and the best time to look is between 10 p.m. to midnight. You'll want to look north, as Draco is a constellation that wraps itself around the Little Dipper and the North Star.
And Sean, do meteor showers ever have like a difference in terms of what colors the meteors are?
Occasionally. It kind of depends on what the composition of the meteors are. Sometimes you'll see greens, which mean they have more oxygen in them. Sometimes sort of yellows or blues that may yield other elements in them.
Right, and that would affect how they look when we see them.
Correct.
Makes sense. How about satellites and other objects like that?
Tuesday morning, catch the Hubble Space Telescope from 4:11 to 4:14 a.m., moving from east to southeast. Wednesday morning, look for the International Space Station from 5:40 to 5:46 a.m., moving from northwest to southeast. And see it again on Friday night from 6:59 to 7:04 p.m., moving from south to east.
Lots to look for. Appreciate the heads up.
Mahalo for having me, Dave.
You are quite welcome. Sean Lotch from the Emi Law Astronomy Center on the Big Island, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next time here for Stargazer.
In today's backyard quiz, we asked you about an innovative communication system developed in the late 1960s at UH Manoa under the leadership of Norm Abramson. Abramson and his team looked for a way to link users around the island chain with a central time-sharing computer on Oahu. They faced a major obstacle. The prevailing standard was point-to-point wireless communication, one signal, one destination at a time. Abramson told his colleagues, something much more sensible for radio can be done here than assigning a single channel for every user in the network. That's crazy. That won't work. His answer was a system that spread the signal being transmitted across the frequency spectrum, allowing several computers to communicate simultaneously without interfering with one another. It was the world's first wireless network. And as we now know, wireless communication has taken over the world. But back in 1969 at UH, AlohaNet was a brand new idea whose possibilities had only begun to be explored. That's our backyard quiz for today. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The foresight and commitment of station members are helping to build HPR into a network with statewide reach. We gratefully acknowledge Elizabeth Gilliland of Honolulu, Stanley Tsukamoto of Mililani, and Mark Bogart and Robbie Bergstresser of Honolulu for their early gifts for Celebration 2013. Station membership is a choice. Are you a member? New members most often join at the $10 a month True Believer level. You can follow the support link at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's 8:49, and you're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Architectural history is not easily preserved. Just as buildings reach the age when they take on historical significance, they can become candidates for the wrecking ball as the drive for modern improvements takes hold. That's too bad, because the way we design our living and working spaces says a lot about us. That's certainly the belief of the Hawaii architects who will be leading a tour of some of the mid-20th century buildings along Honolulu's Miracle Mile this weekend. Mike Gushert is one of them, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Aloha, Chris.
Tell me about this Miracle Mile. What are we describing here?
It's the strip of Kapiolani Boulevard that runs essentially from town toward Waikiki. And as it was developed, it was that main link between those two population centers. And so because there was a lot of traffic and there were a lot of people, banks and retail organizations started popping up along the way, and it was in the middle of the 20th century at this time, this great flourish of modern architecture. So Kapiolani, though a lot of these structures have been overwhelmed by subsequent development, it's dotted with a lot of great pieces of modern architecture.
Which are?
The one that I think people see and notice the most is the Ala Moana building, because it was, you know, when it was built, the tallest building in Hawaii, and has an awesome UFO-shaped, you know, rotating restaurant on top. Mm-hmm. There's also the Ken Rock building, which is a pretty strident example of kind of like the orthogonal design of modern architecture that was designed by Frank Haynes, who also had a hand in the designing of the Capitol. We'll actually have him on hand in the tour to talk about the building. And one of my favorites also is the Blue Cross Animal Hospital by Ossipoff. And that's a really early example of modern architecture. It's the more streamlined. It kind of shows the diversity of styles through time.
What were architects trying to do during this period? What were they breaking away from, you know, just rectangular box design? What was the direction of architecture?
You know, it was kind of diffuse. It was going in many different directions. In the case of the Ken Rock building, it's a series of rectangular boxes. But, mm-hmm. you know, it accepted function as maybe the primary design element of a building. Like, that is the main expression point of a building. So in the case of the Ken Rock building, you have the parking there. Everything is visible, and you can see all the pieces of the building.
That being the tension in all architecture, yeah, form and function?
Yeah, yeah. You know, kind of the if you, to encapsulate modernism, it's something that Louis Sullivan said, which was form follows function. That function will tell you what the building should look like.
But that function should dictate and then make the form work.
For the function, yeah.
Are we seeing the opposite in some architecture? I've seen some modern things that look as if form preceded function by quite a bit.
Well, you know, in some of the cases along our tour line, there's like the Boyce and Paint building, which it has kind of an odd shape and a huge brick wall that pops up out of it. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, wow, the form, you know, they were just kind of trying to make something interesting to look at. But in the case of that building, that is part of the function, was to be seen. It was a sign for itself because you had all of these cars speeding by. Nowadays, there's a lot of buildings that are trying to throw back to the territorial era, and they have, you know, hip roofs even though they're very tall, or chevrons on the side. And, you know, that's a case, I think, of function following form.
What did you say? Hip roofs? What was that?
A hip roof is like, if you think of an old Hawaii-style roof, which, you know, they're beautiful on buildings like the Art Academy building.
Oh, yeah.
Or, you know, but they're popping up on high-rises now and everything, too. So it's just kind of an odd.
It's a shape for the roof,
mm-hmm.
then?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just not a familiar term to
okay.
me.
Sorry. It's, yeah, yeah. It's if you think of the Honolulu Museum of Art is what it is now. It's the kind of pyramidal shape roof.
And does that have a function in terms of deflecting heat or deflecting rain?
Yeah, here heat dissipation is the main purpose.
Because you were telling me that one of the ideas behind the Ala Moana building that you mm-hmm. mentioned earlier was that they had those panels that you can rotate to kind of keep the heat out of the building at the heat of the day?
Yeah, yeah. And it's unfortunate the panels aren't there. They never really worked right. But, you know, sometimes people think of modern architecture as kind of, you know, anti-environment, because the 50s and 60s were when we started kind of moving away from living in a sustainable fashion. But there were lots of architects that were thinking about ways to make buildings kind of fit within their environment. And that was one way that John Graham came up with a set of louvers that moved with the sun and were supposed to reduce the cooling costs of the building.
Is the focus different today?
I think in modern or in current contemporary architecture, there's at least a lot of discussion about creating sustainable buildings. But architects, you know, they have to push their work through a filter of the realities of what their client wants and the kind of short-term economic realities of the world. And so sometimes things get lost in translation.
Well, let's hope some good things get kept, Mike. And thanks thanks very much for coming with us this morning.
Yeah, you know, one more thing. Meet us at Design Within Reach on October 5th. We'll continue our conversation about the places that make Honolulu special.
Terrific. Mike Gushert is an architectural historian, member of the Doko Momo U.S. Hawaii chapter. The group will lead a walking tour of 12 buildings along Kapi'olani Boulevard this Saturday, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Diamond Head Theater. On stage now through October 13th is the musical Cabaret. Tickets and information at diamondheadtheater.com.
Hi, I'm David Freudberg from Humankind. Each week we present the voices of humanitarians. They are people who offer solutions, not just problems, who dedicate their words and their efforts to building a future with more compassion, nonviolence, and generosity of spirit. They're provocative people whose stories are inspiring. Join us for Humankind.
Monday evenings at 6:30, following Marketplace. Support for the conversation comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, announcing Wednesday lectures at 4 p.m. This Wednesday, Museum Director Stefan Yost presents great photographers who happen to be women. HonoluluMuseum.org.
Beth Ann, I remember the first men's march against domestic violence. It's now almost 20 years along, yeah?
19th this year, yes. Next year celebrates 20.
And it's a real change in consciousness, I think, that that event represents, because it's everybody's problem, and I think there's a recognition in that event that on the part of men that they have to own up to some of this.
And also help their younger brethren understand that this is not something that a healthy relationship is all about. And it's going to be slow to change, and it's going to be generationally difficult to get everybody to move along at a similar rate. But the constant reinforcement, at some point, hopefully, that will greatly shift, and it will be far, far better than it is now.
We still see domestic violence kind of trivialized in popular media, and that's troubling.
That's a problem, and that's why I think it's going to be a slower shift on and on. But as David said, if we can get to a little bit better understanding within the employee community and with the various businesses, we'll get it done too.
Can't hurt.
That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, we're going to check in with Brian Black of the Civil Beat Law Center of the Public Interest to see how the center's caseload is developing and how it's doing for journalists and you.
And Hawaii's take on Korean food is different from what is served in the old country, but now there's a new cookbook for it.
You can talk back to your radio anytime you like. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet at HI Conversation, or to me at BecauseHPR.
Our archive is on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.